What I do think will happen after we've gone through this first wave of overfunded AI robotics companies, the next wave is probably going to be like, hey, there's two engineers from Purdue, I'm making this up, two engineers from Purdue who couldn't get any funding because no one knew who they were. They didn't have a lot of connections to venture funds. So all they had was a friends and family round, but they used all these AI tools and there's four people. And now look at what they've done in a year. I think that's like what we're kind of waiting for and will happen, no doubt.
Hello and welcome to the Autonicast. I'm Kirsten Kwarasek, transportation editor at TechCrunch.
And I'm Alex Roy, founder of the Human Driving Association and soon the Human Riding Association, founder and general partner at New Industry Venture Capital, and fan of today's guest, of course, the godfather of mobility venture capital, the OG, the man who, I mean, everyone who listens to this podcast reads him, and if you don't, you're making a mistake. Riley Brennan, founder and general partner at Trucks.VC, and all-around great guy. Welcome, Riley.
Thanks for having me back. Great to see you both. I wish we were with Ed, too, but I'll take two out of three. Not bad.
Ed's delicate voice was delicate. Was hurt at Ride AI, so... Mm. We won't be able to hear his shrill and bitchy tones today.
Was he picked up by the police for setting up protests against Tesla dealerships? Is that what happened?
I don't think so. I think he's safely back where he belongs. But I think you missed one thing in your intro of Riley. And I think most people here in Autonicast know this. Mm. At least our hardcore listeners know that really Riley is the root of the Autonicast.
It's true.
So that you missed that part.
Well, look, for anyone who doesn't know, my career in autonomy and technology investing was kicked off because of a conversation with Riley at South by Southwest 10 years ago, 8 years ago?
10 years ago, yeah. So I don't want to take credit for that, but
you should take credit
the origin. But I mean, you guys did all the work. I just sent a tweet. So
That's not true. That's not true. What happened was a friend named Elizabeth Vallow said, you got to meet this guy, Riley, who's cool. And we get in an Uber to South by Southwest. And I said, and at that point, Tesla had released Autopilot. And I said to Riley, I read this amazing blog on your, that you wrote about what would the dashboard for a fleet operations leader look like in an era of automation and autonomous vehicles. And it was fascinating and brilliant. Future Transportation Newsletter, I don't think it existed at the time. Did it when you published that?
Just starting, maybe. Yeah, something like that. Just starting.
So that blog got me thinking. And then I started thinking, okay, a mile driven in a Tesla and the data pulled off that car. How much data is pulled off that car? And what is the data value, the density and quality of that data compared to a Google self-driving car at that time with multimodal sensor stack? And I asked you that question and you thought for a long time, well, you thought about it and you said, I think that Google data might be more valuable, just 1 mile. And then that set off everything in my head and I have devoted myself to learning about what that data looked like. So thank you, Riley.
Of course. I mean,
does that hold up today that you still view the...
What's fascinating is that, like, think of how many data businesses over the last decade were launched, went public and failed, went bankrupt since we had that discussion, you know? So like the value of the data in and around the vehicle has proven to be elusive for most of these entities, right? I mean, I think downstream, you can assign a lot of that value to valuation right now. But as far as actually the real absolute value of, you know, running a vehicle around for a mile, it kind of remains to be seen, right?
Yeah. You know, I want to get into some of the stuff that you were sort of recently have written. But before we do that, since we are talking about like this initial meeting 10 years ago, I was just thinking actually recently about like how much has changed, which isn't, I guess, super surprising. A lot changes in a decade, but specifically in the mobility space, all the ups and downs, the failures, the reboots. Does it track, like looking back, are there some moments that like actually really truly you're like, yeah, I just completely caught me off guard in terms of how this industry has developed and emerged. Or if you look at all the, you know, connect all the dots and you look at all the hints and things that, and sort of look back, it's like, yeah, that all kind of, I guess, is pretty expected.
I mean, I guess the thing that, I mean, people are still probably in some ways underestimating the impact of Tesla. I certainly did, you know, 10 years ago. And I think when we started trucks, even though we had this belief that software was going to change a lot of transportation, there were still a lot of people who, you know, would laugh at Tesla. And a lot of auto executives then who had never even been in Tesla, never, you know, driven one. I think you could probably still find some now that, you know, haven't taken a Tesla for more than a day and have never charged with it. So that's probably one that's still, like, you know, a little bit underappreciated. Maybe not in the, you know, among the hosts of the Autonicast, but across the industry, I think that's still the case. And then I do think that the Cruise acquisition was a pivotal moment. I know you've written about this before, Kirsten, but, like, you know, that in the spring of 2016 was one of the big tentpole events. And I, you know, I've never written a book, but I've always thought, like, if there was a book about the big sort of M&A deals in auto and technology, that would definitely be in the top 10 that you'd want to know about, because it not only was impactful for that particular group of founders, but GM and then everybody else following GM saying, like, wait, we need to have that. And then all the other projects that got kicked off because of the Cruise acquisition. So that one, I think, was more impactful, even though obviously Cruise is now officially gone. You know, the ramifications for Cruise huge, and a lot of people started things because of it.
Yeah, when you think, I remember that story. I was fortunate at the time, and Dan Primack and I had the initial scoop. I think Dan did most of the work on that one. But what was really shocking to me now that I look back is the number of deals that happened over the next year. Of all sorts, not even just AVs. It was like that future of under that future of transportation umbrella. I mean,
yeah.
When you go back and I look at my stories, I'm like, oh, that's right. You know, GM invested $500 million in Lyft, and Ford bought Chariot, and, you know, like, there's all these crazy deals. All of which have evaporated.
Most have
evaporated, and part of me is like, wow, was that just such a waste of capital? But I also wonder if we, as, like, the collective we, meaning the industry and, you know, like, this whole future of mobility segment, had to go through that to kind of land where we are now. I don't know. I mean, I kind of wonder if we could have skipped all that and then gotten here.
Maybe, I don't know. I mean, where we operate, which is quite early stage, you know, the numbers are always in that kind of 1 out of 15, 1 out of 20. So, you know, we're used to seeing a lot of companies fail at the early stage. I think where your comment is particularly painful is when a lot of those companies that were still early SPAC'd in 2020 and 21, and they still had early stage risk, but they were being treated as if they were a retail stock, like you'd find, you know, Colgate Palmolive or something like that. And they just, most of those companies just weren't ready for that, right? So, yeah, I think that, you know, in fact, that's part of the reason I started writing the FOT newsletter, was because of all the deals that were happening. Because I was like, God, there's so much stuff happening every week. I have to, you know, like, figure out a way to, you know, kind of make sense of it. So that was the genesis of why I started it. If there wasn't a lot of stuff going on, I wouldn't have started FOT.
Yeah. The whole SPAC thing, I understand why companies SPAC'd at the time. Like, if you go back in time, what was happening coming out of the pandemic, this opportunity, and it was like a lot of companies felt they had to do this. But it still is absolutely wild to me, like, on a financial level, that any company. And most have disappeared, by the way. Like,
most, yeah.
Most have been delisted or filed for bankruptcy or, you know, evaporated into the ether. Some are limping along. Yeah. There's very few that are actually, like, still pushing forward.
And the real story of a lot of those companies is A lot of those companies were worth a few hundred million dollars before they SPAC'd. And then after they SPAC'd, they were worth a few billion dollars. And it wasn't because the company was that much better. And it really wasn't even because of the capital that was put into it made it worth that much. It's because a banker all of a sudden arrived at a moment where a lot of those companies could no longer finance in the private markets. So they couldn't, you know, raise another $50 million or $100 million from a late stage VC. And at that point, many of them had actually run out of options. So if you had a banker come to your door, say, hey, we'll, you know, we're going to figure out a way to put $400 to $500 million in this thing. And, you know, this company's going to be worth $2 to $3 billion. And you would have thought maybe 6 months ago, it would maybe be going out of business. It's almost like you, you know, found an absolute savior for the company. So I can't say how many of those 35 automotive SPACs, you know, fall under that description, but I'm going to guess probably like 10 or 15 of them.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that now we went through the whole AV hype cycle, and we were talking a minute ago about all the different deals that were happening, which actually weren't just AV deals. It was like all future of mobility deals. It was pretty crazy. Then there was this period of consolidation, particularly around AVs. Do you feel like AV hype is back now, though, in part because it's getting swept up a little bit with the very extreme amounts of hype around AI?
I mean, AV positivity is back. And I think, you know, the reality of it is you have these two things happening in concert. One, Cruise was off the road, you know, for the last 18 months, right? So it gave Waymo the clean air to run in, and Waymo did a great job. So you had, not only did you have Waymo with the great performance, but kind of all to itself, you know, and if you were a business person that went to San Francisco over the last 18 months, you inevitably took a Waymo. And I know just the sentiment over these last 2 years has been unbelievable for Waymo. So that's one thing, but we haven't seen a ton of new AV startups though. And since we see so much at the really early stage, I think if the hype was similar to what you felt in 2016 or 2017, we would have seen 50 AV startups for on-road AV, you know, robo-taxi-esque ideas. And we just haven't seen that. So we've seen a lot of automated vehicle, off-road, ag, construction, things like that, that are taking advantage of AI. But in terms of like a new robo-taxi company that's, you know, for public roads, we haven't seen that wave. So I don't think it's as hypey at the startup creation phase.
I feel like the Waymo approach, which was also the Cruise and Motional and Argo approach, you know, full stack, you know, multimodal, let's do everything as much as we can, although Waymo's not doing the cars. But that approach is so expensive, takes so long, that if that ship has already sailed, that we're not going to see any more companies like that. And that the future, that beyond Waymo in this country and potentially Zooks, but competitors will on road for passengers will only come from deployments once Wave or Mobileye and Tesla have put them in passenger vehicles, and they work backwards from like a second camp. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, one, I want to, you know, shout out to our friends at May Mobility that are still doing it. Yeah. But you know, just to if Ed was here, he'd say I'm pumping my bags, but you know, he's not here. But I do think, you know, one of the promise of this era of AI, which I don't think we've seen yet, is that you can get a lot more done with, you know, far fewer engineers. You still, to do, you know, operations, you'd still need a huge team. But the interesting part, and I think over the last maybe 12 months, we've seen a lot of new AI robotics companies that, like the pitch deck says, we'll be able to do this instead of 50 engineers, we only need 5. That's theoretically what they say. But then they go ahead and raise a $12 million seed round at 50 post anyway, and then hire the same expensive 500K engineers that you need to hire away from Waymo or, you know, somebody like Wave or something like that. So what I do think will happen after we've gone through this first wave of overfunded AI robotics companies, and maybe that's coming in the next 9 months, is that you'll actually have a proverbially like 4-person, 5-person AV startup. It's not doing operations yet, but actually able to do the engineering work of 50 people. And it's probably going to be from somebody who can't get funding. So like, if you're a name brand engineer and you work at Waymo or Wave or Motional, you can start an AI robotics company and get a ton of funding. In fact, we know of a handful of people that have left Waymo to go do that, you know, in the last year that have raised seed rounds where you're, you know, raising $10 million. The next wave is probably going to be like, hey, there's two engineers from Purdue, I'm making this up, two engineers from Purdue who couldn't get any funding because no one knew who they were. They didn't have a lot of connections to venture funds. So all they had was a friends and family round, but they used all these AI tools and there's four people. And now look at what they've done in a year. I think that's like what we're kind of waiting for and will happen, no doubt.
Do you think that the sort of not brain trust, but sort of like the focus actually like location wise will continue then to be in San Francisco, or is it shifting to other parts of the country where you're seeing these types of startups popping up in the scenario you just kind of played out?
Well, San Francisco has done I think a great job in the last year of like kind of the AI, you know, there's like this whole AI Valley and things that are still going on in San Francisco that are meaningful for this new era. So San Francisco, I think, will still be quite dominant in terms of where founders want to aggregate for some of this stuff. Because it's possible that this new era of AI road vehicle ideas won't be from car company people, it'll be, you know, people who are motivated by AI and then get into cars, which is a little bit what we saw 10 years ago for the first, or for that wave of AV. So it's probably like a few people who were going to work on an AI idea for something else, and then they end up building something for trucks or cars or something like that. And then probably the second piece is like the amount of AI entrepreneurship in China is huge. And we just don't have access to know about a lot of the stuff at the early stages there. And we don't invest in China. So we wouldn't be putting our money there anyway. But that's probably the real answer to your question, is that there's probably more AI engineers at the early stages working on AV stuff in China than there are in San Francisco at the moment.
Yeah, and now there's even there was always a distance and a lack of an opaqueness into that world. And I think with recent political changes, specifically around tariffs and things, and a distancing from China, I just see that becoming even harder to understand exactly what's going on there. I don't know if you agree with that, but it's very hard to get real information about what's truly going on there.
Sure.
One of the most interesting things at the Ride AI conference was Sophie Tung. It was the analyst who did the video not that long ago where she went to China and rode around in a robotaxi. Was it a Baidu? I'm trying to remember. Mm-hmm. Where she basically was comparing it to, you know, her experiences in a Waymo, and they had this, there was still a safety driver in the car. And so there were some issues there, but specifically the overall UX was inferior in terms of pickup or drop locations. There were other factors. So she was at Ride AI, and it was her panel or the subsequent one. One of the guests pointed out, said something I'd never heard before, but I'm not surprised that in China, every automated vehicle, every autonomous vehicle has a black box which transmits all disengagement data and behaviors to the government. And I had not heard that explicitly stated previously. Had either of you heard that?
No.
It sounds too generic of a comment to be real. You know, like a black box, everything. Like both those things together to me sound like I'd love to see a photo, or I'd love to see anything more on that.
Yeah, totally.
It's that's interesting. And of course, our friend Brad Templeton, who was there, says, you know, came up to me afterwards and he says, well, you know, if that's true and no one has access to that data outside of the Chinese government, well, there's only one reason people don't share data. It isn't good. The voice of Templeton.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that's the only reason why you don't share, but
It could mean that the ultimate AV company is actually the Chinese government, right? Like if the Chinese government has the most access to these different companies and they get more data than not only what our regulators get, but what some of our companies get, then the best collection of AV data, from your comment, Alex, is the Chinese government.
I'd like to talk about something you published recently, which is very, very, very important.
And I think you're going to say what I was going to bring up.
Don't mistake ride hailing for AV ride hailing.
Yes.
And back in 2021, I think, I was at Argo, and I had pretty much free rein to write whatever I wanted for the Argo blog and do the On the Argo podcast. But from time to time,
I miss that blog, by the way. It was great. I wish we could archive.org, bring it back and publish it tomorrow.
I have it. I have the archive, okay. And I'm going to begin republishing them with updated notes to where I was right and wrong. But I published something back then, which I forgot about until I read your blog. And I was asked to write a column about why Argo was choosing to launch on the Lyft network. And we were testing, the Lyft network. And I forget if they had already invested in Argo at that point. And so the column I wrote about was that why it made perfect sense for an AV company to deploy first and potentially forever on someone else's network, a Lyft or an Uber, that was aggregating human-driven ride hail with autonomous vehicles. And I did my best to articulate it. And of course, I came under attack from Tesla fans because the Tesla network was, already been announced, as well as some people associated with Cruise because they were developing an app. I didn't come under attack from anyone at Waymo. And then, Argo shut down and that went away. I mean, the argument I made was, well, AVs in their early stages will not be ubiquitous. Therefore, the lowest point of friction for a customer is to be on a platform where they're guaranteed a ride no matter what kind of ride it is. Yep. And that what I didn't articulate it as you're about to. And I didn't quite see, I understood the contours of my argument, but I didn't make it in as lucid a way as I wanted. And then you published your column 3 weeks ago. Can you walk us through your thesis?
Sure.
Because it's really important.
That was like
really
the longest wind up, by the way, to just asking Riley a very basic question.
Well it's all from the Autonicast.
I think it's an important wind up, though, because these are complex ideas and oftentimes a very important idea. It has to come from the person who's thought it through and can make the case simply. And no one has done it until Riley. So tell us about your column.
Yeah. I mean, the idea, well, I think a lot of people thought that Uber surge pricing was just Uber trying to extract more money out of a consumer. And you could view it back then like that, perhaps. But when you really dig into why surge pricing was necessary, it was so that they could bring more vehicles onto the network. And the net effect of that is that the network design or the number of vehicles you need in a city is not determined by how many vehicles exist or how many medallions you might have for example, in a taxi network. It's based solely on the demand that you have from your customers. So what's fascinating, I think, is that the network is really driven by the demand. And the beauty of, in Uber's case, when those cars aren't needed, they go back home in the garages of their individual owners, and Uber doesn't have to pay for that. So the fundamental question when you're designing an AV network is, would you want to design the network to the base load of vehicles you have during any point in the day? Or do you design the network to basically the peak load, which is during your commuting waves and, your social times at night? And that's a fundamental question you'd have to ask when designing, whether it's Waymo or May Mobility or anybody for one of these cities. And there are obvious trade-offs. And if you design for peak load, then there's a lot of times during the day when those vehicles are losing money. And if they're owned by one entity, like a Waymo, then Waymo suffers that cost. So that's one of the really kind of fascinating parts of how an individually owned vehicle is so valuable to that type of network design, and why Uber had advantages going back over the last decade because of individual ownership, why Waymo might struggle with a network design today, but also importantly in the future, at some point, why Tesla might be a great beneficiary of that network design once their FSD network is up and running This is when I really wish Ed was here to make a comment about
I
that,
can but. Play the role of Ed for our purposes.
Yeah, I'm happy to do
and
that.
And I will,
well.
But go on.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the idea. And it basically says, if you were to design a network, you have to make a decision about how you would treat base and peak load. And in my mind, means that Tesla, if you use the FSD launch of company-owned vehicles as the base load, and then supplement when you need to go into those peak hours, like in commuting and social time, just have the individually owned Teslas that are owned by Alex Roy to go float into the network for a few hours, do their work, and then go back home. That mix of company-owned plus individually-owned would be a magical thing for an AV network in the future. And not every company can do it. In fact, I would argue really, at least in the U.S., just Tesla could do it.
But technically, Tesla can't do anything because it doesn't, this is all theoretical. Like, it hasn't proven anything yet.
It's not possible today.
That's your impression of Ed, Kirsten?
No,
that was it?
I mean, I...
Can I try? Like, but what about the operations team? I mean, Tesla has to have an operations to manage the base load, and then they have to integrate with for the peak load, the consumer could donate cars.
You lost me. So, I do actually have a legitimate question instead of impressions. Doesn't the partnership with Uber and Waymo, the Waymo on Uber, as it's called, which is, again, terrible like branding, but in Austin, in a way, kind of achieve that? Yeah, granted, it's the base load. There is
autonomous
that is augmented by human drivers, but my experience there was very much like you could see how these two things could operate together, where driverless is used in either specific areas or at specific times, and then the human drivers are there. I mean, doesn't that get kind of close? Or is your point?
It's probably a good hybrid for today. You know, it's like today's network design with today's technology as we see it, you would want a Waymo baseload and an Uber peak load. There are some obvious problems with that. One is, if you take away all the baseload rides from all the drivers, are they incentivized enough to even take on the peak load 3 or 4 hour chunks, on a Friday night? And maybe there's fewer drivers overall because they're no longer able to get, a baseload of revenue for themselves during the day. That's one question. The other one is just, what do you do with basically over time as that changes? Are you consistently modifying the fleet size? So like, is the fleet really growing as a city grows, or as AV rides get cheaper, are people taking more rides and things like that? But today's version of the best answer to that question is exactly, Kirsten, what you described.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, in the future, there will be hardware and software that will be conformal and installable on pass-through-own vehicles. I'm guessing Mobileye, Wave.
I agree. Whether it's Tesla licensing that, which is possible, whether it's Wave, whether it's May Mobility on a, a OEM vehicle, whether it's Qualcomm, Mobileye, it's certainly feasible that you have something that makes today's car parked in a garage 95% of the time. You could send that into a network. You can't do it today, but theoretically you could. The only vehicle that has been designed in quotes to do that is a Tesla vehicle. And I find it interesting even for me to say that, because, every week if I happen to write about Tesla and FOT, I have people who call me a Tesla hater, or sometimes people think I'm a Tesla fanboy or a Tesla hater, which I think the only real kind of safe spot is to be in the middle where people hate you from both sides.
That's my favorite spot.
That's my spot too.
By all.
Yeah. But I think that the Tesla network design today is the best of all the TNCs and OEMs because of that. Now, I'm not saying that FSD works, but if it does, the way that they've constructed the ownership model and the company-owned fleet model, it would be the best as of, April 2025.
Yeah.
I mean, an interesting component to that is that, the base load being operated by a company like Waymo, is optimized by having a main depot and a forward depot in your highest demand location to reduce deadheading, and which also mitigates risk of congestion pricing, which might be levied specifically on deadheading at a different rate than any other vehicle. And if Tesla were to have their own managed fleet of some base size, and then there's contributed vehicles from private owners. If those owners are individuals who have one car, the peak demand dictates that car will be contributed to the network at peak load, which is generally the precise time the owner of that car, if that's their sole vehicle, needs it for themselves.
Sure.
Which then would require, which would then kick the likely demand for peak load in a Tesla network scenario over to mini fleets managed by people who make it as a small business in the way that, say, Airbnb owners might have a portfolio of homes. And the closest analog to that are the people who manage multiple cars on the Turo network. So we have already seen, what that looks like in a human driven scenario, underneath the kind of rental concept.
I agree with the same thing, though, in that example, the peak times though are hours long. And if it's your Tesla that's, going into the network for 4 hours and you need to go to dinner, that might be a 20-minute chunk. It's kind of the same way that an Airbnb owner blocks off Christmas day on their calendar because they want to use their house, but there's all these other days they don't. And so even within that example, a Tesla owner might actually be getting a FSD ride in their own car and get out at dinner and then send it back to the network. So I agree with you, but I think it'll be solved relatively easily if it works as well as some people say.
I'm curious. I mean, I agree with you. It will be solved. At one point, Turo had airport lots, like they had a lot at SFO and at LAX, and then that turned out not to make sense. I forget exactly, were they being taxed like a rental company, and that's why they
gave us those lots? Yeah, I think that's right.
And so ever since, there's a parking lot next to a shopping center right by LAX now with a big Starbucks. And that lot is where there are at least two competing fleets that are privately managed, just parking there and using Starbucks as their office. So yeah, it's solvable. Although I am curious to know if an individual who does not have the ability to stage multiple cars at such a location wants to contribute their sole car or two cars that they have at their home, I kind of feel like the likelihood that they will be as close as a staged fleet or the base fleet to the demand locations is low. And therefore, they will be subject to, if there's congestion pricing, higher costs and time, and there'll be some friction there. Solvable too, but I feel like over time, they'll be crowded out.
I agree.
Yeah, I think in the beginning, and again, this is like completely theoretical because, to be clear, the technology doesn't exist in commercial form.
Is this your Ed voice?
No, it's not my Ed voice, but it is the reality. So I'm just setting the foundation here. So this is all theoretical, but I could see it being a novelty for people initially. But the one thing that like is going to be interesting to see how Uber handles it with the Uber Waymo deal in Austin is the charging, maintenance, and cleaning of the vehicles. And I think that actually, just the logistics of that alone, remember how Airbnb first started and how and what it's turned into? There was like all these cleaning fees now, and there's like things have changed, and so it's I guess more buttoned up, but it's also more expensive, and it's a lot of people operate it like as a portfolio and a business, and it's not as many people who are just like the casual Airbnb providers. They're more business minded, and I could kind of see the same thing happening on a theoretical basis here with the Tesla network, because if you have one and someone throws up in it, then you're the one who's having to, clean up the vehicle that's been used. I mean, there are whole businesses around fleet management, and I could see people doing this as a novelty in the beginning and either making a decision to then invest in a bunch of other Teslas and creating a business, or just saying, you know, just opting out and not doing it because of that cleaning and maintenance piece.
Riley, I got taking her question one step further. Is this potentially a great future for car dealerships who are looking for a role in a future of autonomous vehicles, mm-hmm. given their proximity to major markets?
Or it's somebody who's, and service, I mean, to be honest, car dealerships don't do a great job of this. It's probably a future for a company like Enterprise Mobility, right? Where you already have a ton of them. You're used to turning vehicles, cleaning them, washing them, charging them. So a provider like that, strategically placed, you know, around these demand locations, is actually right now a better answer to that than a local car dealer, you know?
Could you see like even almost like a gig economy style? Like, remember when the whole scooter craze was happening and mm-hmm. the folks Those who would go around putting, and get yeah. paid for charging? Do you see that? Angels. I mean, obviously much more expensive componentry, bigger vehicle. There's a lot more going on here. But do you see sort of like a gig economy sort of industry coming up around AVs, or is it just too complex of a piece of technology to sort of put out to a, you know, bunch of random people? I mean,
the things you really need are, you know, charging and washing. Those are the two key
and real
things.
Estate.
You're not doing, yeah, you need to have the real estate for it. So the dumb answer is like, okay, it's probably just a car wash. With some charging, or it's probably a rental car provider, or it could be a gas station that expands this. Those are probably the first answers to it. And then there's probably something that we can't even imagine, that some business that's created down the road. What's fascinating to think about, though, is that I don't know if the operations are, like, if you look at what Waymo's done with their agreements with Uber and this other company, Move, you know, Waymo doesn't really want to, they've signaled at least that they don't love the demand and operations part. I'm not saying that that's Waymo's strategy overall, but what they've done in Texas is you have to use Uber to call a Waymo, right? You're not actually using the Waymo app. And so they've at least given the hint that the operations are something they want to do less and less of over time.
Right.
Now, why is that? To them, it's, you know, if you want to scale globally, or at least scale through the US, it's way less expensive if you turn it over to a partner. So I'm, in my mind, it kind of sets up, you know, the eventual probably Waymo IPO, you know, in a few years, because they're making moves that suggest they want to be in a lot more cities faster than they ever have.
Yeah, they when they had the partnership with Move, I thought that was the biggest indicator, and then of course now we see what's happening in Austin. And I'm very curious to see what happens out of that, because my understanding is Uber is also working with a third party that all a different Move that's since changed its name, which is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But
yeah.
They are handling, my understanding is that Waymo is still responsible, obviously, for the technology. And also if there's like the emergency call or the call that comes in from the vehicle, but the maintenance and like the routing mm-hmm. is all Uber or this third party through Uber.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like a very complicated dance if they can nail it. And you know, Uber does have years of experience in terms of all the networking piece of it, the routing and all that. That is, to me, going to be the biggest test to see if this kind of relationship can really work. And repeated, and
we're starting to fracture the work of what was a startup and a prototype into different companies and maybe even these little markets, right? Which is not dissimilar from 20th century airline development too. You know, originally you had Boeing thinking it wanted to be in operations. Now if you look at, you know, who services a plane, you have all these different layers of value. You have an avionics, you know, set of companies that do that. You have an airframe manufacturer, you have airlines. And then when you get to the gate, there's of course these a food company and there's a cleaning company. So an AV layer is like the seven layers of Taco Bell burrito in 10 years, you know, and what are the companies that are going to be extracting value from that? It's an open question whether Waymo can capture all of or most of the high margin stuff there. I think that's the big question when you think about Waymo. And does it have to get into the business of installing its technology on other on third party vehicles or individually owned vehicles? Because that's certainly where the rest of the industry appears to be headed.
Interesting. I mean, what we've seen, I mean, Waymo is obviously, you know, was first and like closest to perfecting how operations should work. And now first to trying to spin out operations and look at not just one, but multiple potential operation solutions. And I've said, Ed has said too, that Tesla cannot deploy a network to manage base load out of their own vehicles unless they spin up our operations. Have we seen any indication that Tesla has looked to like leapfrog that step and just go straight to a third party? I haven't seen that. Do we know, Kirsten? Ed?
I'd
be curious because if they're launching in just one, I mean, the question I'm asked most frequently is, what are we going to see in June in Austin? And my answer is always, we're going to see the minimum viable deployment to keep the Tesla narrative moving forward. So a very limited ODD that so they can maintain narrative command of autonomy. And the smaller that ODD, that June deployment, the easier it is to stand up the smallest possible operations unit and then jump to the outsourcing part.
And Kirsten, is that going to be run out of a previously, you know, already owned Tesla facility near their Austin headquarters, or is it a totally different thing?
All I know based on just some insider, you know, info is that they have, you know, that's why I brought up the real estate play or comment earlier, is some sort of depots, but it's not clear if that is like they're, you know, that's down the line, but there's definitely some activities on the like setting up depots side of things. I mean, I think it's going to be like Alex predicted, like a minimum viable product. I think it's going to be employees of Tesla doing this for the foreseeable future. And I think of like the Boring Company and the launch in Vegas as like a good example. Like, I don't know if you've ridden in that, but it's like,
I have.
It's like not exactly smooth. It's very much, you know, it's certainly not autonomous. And it's, I don't see it progressing beyond that for some time. And so I could see that on the autonomous side of things happening in Austin for a while.
I can't believe I'm going to say this, but what, Riley, have you been in the Boring Company thing?
I haven't done a ride in the Vegas tunnels, no.
So, I mean, yeah, Kirsten's correct. And if Ed were here, he'd be like, it's trash. It's stupid. It makes us, the throughput is nothing. It's
a waste of money. It's like riding in a wooden roller coaster. It's not a smooth ride, by the way.
But let me say this. It is the fastest way to get from the convention center to Resorts World. It's like, it's a couple of minutes and it's like a dollar. It's nothing. And boy, as an actual product, it solves a very critical need right now. And I can't believe I'm saying
it. I can't believe you're defending it.
I can't believe I'm defending it. But if you've ever, anyone who's ever been to Vegas, the convention center for anything, who's trying to get off site at peak demand, it could be 30 to 40 minutes wait for an Uber, and it's cold and the monorail is not awesome. And I can't believe I'm saying this. Let's just drop it.
I do have, before we wrap up, I had like two quick questions. One very quick one, which is we haven't really talked about Zoox at all, which really is, you know, on the cusp of opening up commercial rides and they're custom built. And I'm wondering how that works in like your thinking around, because that's a totally different one. This is a custom built one. So you can't really put it on like an Uber now. I mean, I guess you could, but you could put it on an Uber network. You could put it on a Lyft network, but it's so custom built. I'm just wondering if sort of the model you put out there works with such a very specific type of vehicle, or if it doesn't matter at all.
Well, I mean, I think that what's fascinating about Zoox is the vehicle itself was designed for the optimal sensor placement, you know, like as opposed to a lot of these other vehicles that were first designed for humans to be inside of them. And then let's figure out a the best way to hang sensors around this really place for humans to sit. And the Zoox vehicle, you know, was designed from the very beginning during, what was it called, Alex? Horseshit. What was the horseshit name they had? Remember they, there were it was like a Jalopnik writer said something in passing and then they named the vehicle that, but whatever. In any case,
Ed would remember this.
Ed would remember. Any case, you know, that's why the vehicle looks like a four post bed, right? Cause that's actually the best place to hang the sensors. And so, I don't know anything about the corporate strategy of Zoox, but I don't think there's a world where Zoox, you can just, you know, upgrade your Chevy to have Zoox technology today. And which I don't think is a bad thing, but it means it will probably just serve, you know, the base load in certain cities. And a big question for Zoox is it going to be its own network or is it just going to live as, you know, base load vehicle on an Uber and Lyft network and other things. I think it's still too early to say. And that's definitely been one of the sleeping giants of the AV world over the last 5 years. Like what exactly is Zoox doing? And I think there's been more enthusiasm about that over the last year as, you know, people have been able to take rides. There was that big Wall Street Journal piece by Tim Higgins recently. So yeah, I'm excited. I haven't ridden in the new one. So looking forward to it.
And I did twice actually in Vegas and we had a whole episode about it. So I won't, you know, bore you with that. But I will say that the first ride that I took with Ed was actually very complicated. Like we encountered all sorts of situations and yeah, sure. It's in a big boulevard, you know, setting like Vegas is different than San Francisco, but there was a lot going on and, you know, crowded and construction and two car crashes and pedestrians and stuff like that. And a lot of it was handled well. Actually, like my whole thing was on the business model side, I felt like it needed to be a far plusher suspension and like, cause that to me was more the pitch, you know, for someone who would want to ride in that. Like it has to be nicer. I could see some people arguing, no, it can just be utilitarian. It doesn't need to be nice. But then I'm like, well, then it's just like a monorail, right? Like then it's, then it's public transit and will people pay for that? So, you know, I'll be curious to see how it ends. The one last thing I wanted to ask you about is you launched a new fund in January, TechCrunch wrote about it. And I'm wondering if like the recent political changes, tariffs, like just how everything is changing the mood. Mm-hmm. If that is in any way changing how you're investing in companies.
Yeah, we did. We launched Trucks launched its third fund in January. Thanks for you know writing about the launch of that with my partners, Jeff, Kate, and Panith. I think we're looking for stuff that is just trying to make transportation a lot better and the way that people are raising money now, I think is fundamentally different than it was even 2 years ago. I think you have huge rounds and tiny rounds. And so you have like the example I gave you a few minutes ago was, you know, X Waymo people raising a $10 million seed round. You can find that a lot in the markets and you still have, you know, Y Combinator companies that are raising, you know, a $10 million seed round. You also have, you know, pre-seed kind of size rounds under $1 million with a lot of AI talent that's just starting to pick up. So we're just trying to basically get 10% of a great idea. That's how I think about it. So if you have a great team working in an interesting part of transportation, we're interested in backing it. And our fund has changed a little bit, I'd say over the last few years, because we've done a lot more in aviation and aerospace than we ever did in the beginning of our fund, which was mostly automotive. So we've done a good amount there. And we just saw, I feel like you guys might feel the same way, I don't know, but I feel like I've seen everything. And then you talk to somebody, you know, with an idea that just like you've never even thought of before. And I just got out of one of those calls yesterday, you know, the two ex Volvo guys working on something, in Sweden and it, you know, really exciting. So it's potentially a great time to have a new fund when, you know, the markets are sideways and people are fearful, it's, you know, historically been a good time to have a fund. So we'll see. So we just launched it.
One last follow up, Alex, then you can jump in. Sure. Sorry. I'm just wondering if you're like, you're the types of startups that you're looking at, and let's say you're looking at three that are really interesting, but ultimately you decide to invest in the one that's like the most protected from the volatility with tariffs and things like that. Or is that like just way too early since a lot of these are early stage companies?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we invest so early that in some ways our best, most aggressive ideas will still take 5 years before they start to bloom. And the slower ones closer to 10 years. So we don't think about it as much. I mean, obviously tariffs are front of mind for the whole industry. So I think what is changing is our portfolio companies that need to work with automakers now have to have a lot of understanding of how tariffs might fit into those contracts or business development. But it doesn't change what we fund today at the moment. And we're not investing in, you know, manufacturing plants and things like that. If we were, then it would be changing that a lot.
Alex, you get the final word.
You know, going back to the base versus peak topic, you know, when Uber launched, it was black car, and Lyft launched, it was in a different band of vehicle. Mm-hmm. And then over time, the two platforms grew such that there were vehicles in every size and price band. And both have experimented with shared rides, and which required kind of rerouting and then offered preferential pricing. A couple months ago, I saw Ed Olson give a really great presentation about May and its costs. And he was comparing their cost structure to Waymo, and they were coming in a lot lower. And he was talking about their growth. And now, you know, I'm going to go up to Michigan in a couple of days to get a ride up there. Where do you see, you know, because given their form factor and where they are in the market, where do you see them fitting into this base versus peak load thesis in the aggregator platforms?
Yeah. I mean, I guess one of the interesting parts about May is that if you just look at what they've done with how much money they've raised and the team size is pretty remarkable in terms of efficiency. And they have a big partner in Toyota. Right now, the vehicle would just be for the base load. So they, you know, run in a totally May-owned and operated fleet. They don't install on third-party individually owned vehicles. That might change down the road. It's possible that May does end up working with automakers that allow you to basically have some of that stuff on a vehicle. So down the road, that could be a little bit different, but right now it would just be baseload. And yeah, I think May has an opportunity in part, frankly, because they didn't SPAC like 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And they've just sort of stuck to their knitting and, proud of what they've done. So, I'm excited to, you know, for the next few years of May. And we were the first investor, and I was first board member of May.
If I may ask one more question, Kirsten, forgive
we're
me.
We're still over time, but fine, go ahead.
But this is Riley Brennan. You don't just
get yes, I'll allow it. Go ahead.
Where do you stand on the debate over the actual progress of the of Chinese AVs versus reality? Because the narrative is, oh, they're light years ahead, they're this, they're that. I've seen so few credible coverage of firsthand experience from people who understand the technology who've gone there to test these vehicles. You have a point of view?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess one of the things about one of the most interesting and consequential parts of any of the AV companies is what happens during when things go wrong. And I think of the Chinese companies as having one of those foam pits to fall into because of, you know, the kind of not only government and media and kind of cultural support for them is a lot different than it is in the United States. So the big question is, when will the U.S. have its first AV rider death? And because of the launches that you know, are coming in the next year or two. It's inevitable that that happens in the United States. The follow-up is, of course, has that already happened in a Chinese AV company that we don't know about? If it were to happen in 6 months on the same day as an American company were to have an issue like that, which culturally, which company would survive that and which one wouldn't? And I think my guess here is that it would mean something very differently in the US versus China. So I think the real answer to like the staying power of one of these entities is like, well, what do you do after something has happened as traumatic as that? And therefore, I think you have to think about like a lot of those Chinese companies are going to have the equivalent of the Rob Dyrdek foam, you know, play pit, and the US companies won't. For better or worse, I'm not saying that we should have that or they shouldn't, but it's just the difference between how we treat technology and how they do.
Alex, you're not allowed any more questions or follow-ups.
Yeah, that's it, Alex.
Thank you, Riley, for joining us.
Thanks, Alex, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks. And thanks to our audience for listening to another episode of the Etonicast.
Well, I was on Twitter last night. Someone posted a screenshot from the opening crawl of The Phantom Menace. Does everyone remember the opening crawl?
I do.
Riley, I'm giving away the baby here, Riley. The world famous Riley Brennan is our guest today. The opening crawl, if I recall correctly, something that's like, you know, trade war has broken out, taxation of trade routes is basically the context and bookends of The Phantom Menace. And I remember people saying, that's so boring. Who cares? It doesn't matter. Sure matters now.
Sure does.
Sure matters now.
Before we jump in the show, I'm wondering if you went ahead and actually ordered that Mod Bikes e-bike with the sidecar.
Well, you know, I just came back from the Red AI conference and I must have been asked that question a dozen times. And my answer is I would rather, if they offered it in is it Rad Power Bikes? Who makes that thing, that sidecar?
No, Mod Bikes. They're in Austin.
Mod Bikes.
They're an Austin
based company. So yeah. It's super cool, but upon reflection, it's basically modeled on an Africa Corps World War II reconnaissance bike. And I'm really looking for more like Gendarme de Saint-Tropez sidecar vibe. So maybe if they could offer one with like a Saint-Tropez beach patrol on the side and I could wear a kepi hat, then I would buy it. But I've got two.
I think the Infinite Machines guy should do one. You know, the Infinite Machines P1. People have said it looks like a Cybertruck scooter. I don't know if they were at Ride AI.
Oh, right.
No. I feel like that with a sidecar would be a contemporary Alex Roy Scottsdale ride, you know?
Is that the guy who came to your conference like 2 years ago?
Yeah.
That's super cool. I love Collins, that thing.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. Look, I've got you said years ago, who's going to make the F-150 of micromobility? And I've got two electric X Peaks 1.0 Gen 1. These things are bulletproof, and I love them.
Well, we can't turn this back into like advertisement.
I don't work for electric. I haven't talked to that guy since he came on the show, but it's a great bike.